I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
Today on Tell Somebody, Professor Robin Muncy talks about her new biography, Relentless Reformer, Josephine Roche and Progressivism in 20th Century America. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Welcome to Tell Somebody for March 5th, 2015, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. Look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook and like it. And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. This is your host, Tom Clammer. The views and opinions expressed on this show are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the station or anybody else involved with it. The podcast of last week's show has been posted. Look for a link at tellsomebody.us. On that show, we heard from Katie Escobar, the social media director and outreach coordinator at If Americans Knew, filling in for If Americans Knew founder, journalist and author Allison Weir. Allison Weir will be one of two speakers tonight, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Tomahawk Ridge Community Center, 11902 Lowell, Overland Park, Kansas. This will be a debate, What Americans Need to Know About Israel, Two Perspectives. The other speaker will be Dr. Anat Maor from Israel, a former Knesset member. They will offer their contrasting perspectives, followed by a Q&A. More information on that event and more at the Citizens for Justice in the Middle East website, www.cjme.org. Also tonight, at the UMKC Student Union Theater at 5100 Cherry in Kansas City, Missouri, the Economics Club of UMKC, KC Move to Amend and the Mainstream Coalition will present the film Pay to Play, Democracy's High Stakes. The film makes the case against corporate personhood and money as free speech. More information on that at www.kcmovetoamend.org. On with the show. Today you will hear a conversation with Professor Robin Muncy. We'll be talking about her new biography about Josephine Roche. Now, I'm guessing that most of you have never heard of Josephine Roche, but as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under FDR, she was the second highest-ranking woman in the New Deal in the 1930s and was almost like a rock star in the media of the day, a familiar name to anyone who read the newspaper. She had a long list of major accomplishments before, during, and long after her work at Treasury, but, in spite of that, seems to be as anonymous these days as she was prominent 80 years ago. This book might change that a little bit, at least. This biography is titled Relentless Reformer, Josephine Roche and Progressivism in 20th Century America, published this year by Princeton University Press. After seeing Professor Muncy talking about the book on C-SPAN recently, I contacted her and arranged to record this phone conversation. Give a listen. Robin Muncy is Associate Professor of History at the University of Maryland. She was born in Kansas City, Kansas, and began her education as a child in Liberty, Missouri, some of it in a one-room schoolhouse. ultimately earning a PhD in American history from Northwestern University. She is the author of Creating a Female Dominion in American Reform, 1890 to 1935, and the co-author of Engendering America, a Documentary History, 1865 to the Present, and most recently is author of Relentless Reformer, Josephine Roche, and Progressivism in the 20th Century America. Robin Muncy, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
How did you first hear of Josephine Roche?
I first happened on Josephine Roche when I was preparing a course for my students at the University of Maryland on the history of democracy in America. And I wanted to have primary sources from each of several periods. And I'd come to the moment where I wanted to find a document to illustrate for my students what Americans meant by industrial democracy in the 1930s. And I thought the perfect place to find that document would be in the proceedings of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. You probably know the CIO was a new and militant labor federation that was emerging in the 1930s, and it was devoted to what the founders called industrial democracy. So I thought, oh, I could go to the proceedings of the founding convention, which occurred in 1938, and there I would certainly find, I thought, speech after speech that would lay out what workers meant by industrial democracy. So I went to those. There's a transcript. It's huge, really fat transcript of the proceedings of the founding convention of the CIO. And I was reading through those and just having an awfully good time when I came to a moment in the proceedings when a former coal miner got up to the podium and said, and now I want to introduce, his words, the greatest woman of our time and the most outstanding liberal. And I imagined that it would, of course, be Eleanor Roosevelt. He would say, and now here's Eleanor Roosevelt. But instead, he said, here's Josephine Roche. And I thought, who the heck is Josephine Roche? What? I was a 20th century U.S. historian. I was a women's historian. I had written on progressive reform, and I thought I knew a thing or two about who would be the most outstanding women and liberals of the 1930s, and here was somebody I'd never heard of. And so I began to do a little research on her at that moment. And, of course, as I went, it didn't take long. It didn't take long at all to find out a little about who she was because she was in the papers constantly in the 1930s. But everything I found out about her then just increased my curiosity about her, and that's where it all started.
You know, hearing many of those descriptions, you said at the CIO introduction you would have guessed Eleanor Roosevelt. On a lot of those descriptions, I would have guessed Frances Perkins.
And she would have been another option. If it hadn't been Eleanor Roosevelt, I would have thought it would have been Frances Perkins. That's absolutely right. And, of course, Frances Perkins and Roche had a lot in common. They'd known each other when they had both been master's students in political science at Columbia University back in the teens, and they'd worked on various reform campaigns as younger women in the teens and 20s. And of course, eventually they both appeared in the Roosevelt administration during the New Deal. And Frances Perkins is, for us, of course, a lot better known because she was the first woman to hold a cabinet-level position and has hung on in historical memory in a way that obviously Josephine Roche had not. So, yeah, Frances Perkins would have been another candidate.
How is it that this woman, with all these accomplishments, and, you know, I'll leave it to you how much you want to directly answer the question right now and how much, you know, will just be revealed as we go along. But how does someone with such incredible accomplishments become so unknown to us presently?
Right. It's such a really important question and one that I wrestled with like crazy in the book. And I think there are lots of layers to the answer for that question, but two of the most important have to do with the anti-communist crusade of the late 40s and 50s and a kind of ageist sexism that also helped to wipe her out of our historical memory. To go to the part about the anti-communist crusade, I would say that Roche had a long career of association with people who were farther left than she was, and the kind of political alliances that she had cultivated and that she had participated in the teens, 20s, and 30s, those kinds of political alliances became really dangerous kinds of alliances to have in your resume by the late 40s and through the 1950s because of the Cold War and the kind of power that the Cold War gave to the anti-communist strain in American political culture. I think everybody, all of your listeners, will be really familiar with McCarthyism and the power of that anti-communist crusade in the late 40s and through the 50s to stifle dissent by making it seem anti-American, treasonous even, to critique America as it was at the moment and to have a past in which you associated with anybody on the left. And Roche certainly had that set of associations. And so she saw the writing on the wall and was, by the time she got to the 1940s and 50s, involved in a whole new undertaking that she really believed in very powerfully. She was, at that point, the director and eventually a trustee of the United Mine Workers of America Welfare and Retirement Fund. And she was just kind of getting it on its feet when the anti-communist crusade became its most powerful. And so wanting to protect that new vulnerable institution, she, I think, began to dodge the public spotlight for fear that her associations with the left in earlier years might be a danger to this new undertaking. So she really kind of dropped out of public sight, I think on purpose. I can't absolutely confirm that. She never said that out loud. She never wrote that down that I know of or that I've been able to find. But it sure looks like she deliberately pulled herself out of the limelight and kept as low a profile as she could in the 40s and 50s because of her fear of this anti-communist crusade. And then when those anti-communist pressures were alleviated a little bit in the 1960s and she could reemerge into public life, and she did, but at that point she was a really old woman and she had thick glasses and a knobbed cane and hearing aids. And at that point, I think it was very hard for anybody in American society and politics or in the media to imagine that this skinny old woman with hearing aids and glasses could possibly have the kind of power that Josephine Roche did have in the 1960s and 70s, or that she could have done the kinds of things that she did earlier. I think this sexist ageism or ageist sexism kicked in and just made it impossible for most to imagine her as the powerhouse that she was then and had been. So I think it's a combination of the fear instilled by the anti-communist crusade and then this inability to see the power and accomplishments of an old woman by the time we get to the 1960s and 70s that most explains how she dropped out of our historical memory so completely.
Wow, there are about 60 different directions I would love to go on this. I'll have to pick one, I guess. You know, as I think I wrote you, the name of Josephine Roche meant nothing to me at first, and then I recalled, you know, reading up about the Ludlow Massacre.
Oh, yeah.
Coming across some mention of a woman who more humanely ran coal mines in the northern fields after Ludlow. And, you know, I just kind of assumed, I think, she inherited Daddy's coal mine when he died. She was a bleeding heart liberal, and she tried to be nice until the money ran out. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to her than what my biases led me to assume, wasn't there?
Right. I mean, I think that's such a beautiful statement, really, of I think what most of us would have thought Right, because we do assume that, I mean, in the case of her story, at Rocky Mountain Fuel, the coal company that she inherited from her dad, in the case of that story, we just can't imagine a woman in the 1920s, you know, being a coal magnate. It just doesn't seem in the realm of possibility. And so since it's so contrary to what we expect, we just don't register it. And that's a beautiful analogy, I think, to what I believe happened in the 1960s and 70s for her. It's a beautiful analogy that she, what she, who she was and what she had done and what she was even doing at that moment was just so contrary to expectation that people couldn't see it, couldn't register it. Yeah, that's a beautiful analogy.
Well, let's talk about some other things that defy expectations. First female cop in Denver, deputy sheriff. Talk a little bit about how that came about.
Right. Yes, that Josephine Roche was a vice cop is just, you know, hilarious in so many ways. And she really got a lot of press in 1912 when she became the first, she was called in the press usually, the first policewoman in Denver. And so, yeah, that was one of her first kind of gender breakthroughs, and one, as you know, of many. The way that that came about was that she, as you probably know, she became a progressive reformer really first at Vassar College. She went to Vassar between 1904 and 1908. And by the time she came out of Vassar, she was clearly committed to progressivism, that is to diminishing inequalities of wealth and power in the U.S., especially by using the tools of public policy. There are other aspects of that, too, but public policy was at first the major tool that she saw of value in sort of counterbalancing the power of corporations in American life. And her first, the first job that she had as a progressive reformer when she first came out of Vassar was with the juvenile court in Denver. Her mom and dad had moved to Denver while she was in college, and so she moved to Denver. She lived in Denver with them for a year while she worked at Benjamin Lindsay's juvenile court. And the juvenile court was at that time a brand spanking new kind of institution. It was kind of still in the process of being crafted and shaped. That whole juvenile justice system, with which we are so familiar, was just coming into being in the early 20th century as an alternative to just putting kids in jail with adults. And Ben Lindsay was at the head of this movement to create a juvenile justice system, particularly for kids. So Josephine Roche goes to work in the juvenile court and becomes very familiar with various problems of youth in an industrial and corporate economy. And so she had experience in Denver. She got very much involved during that year with this really interesting reforming community that congealed around Benjamin Lindsay. He was a real mover and shaker, and had people like a lawyer named Edward Costigan, who was a great progressive leader and would eventually go to the U.S. Senate during the New Deal as a New Deal senator. His wife, Mabel Costigan, was also a progressive reformer. So there was editor of the Rocky Mountain News, Edward Keating, who was a pro-labor journalist as well as for a while congressman from Denver. There's a really interesting group of people around Ben Lindsay who became Roche's best friends and political mentors, who opened all kinds of possibilities for her over the course of many years. So this year that she spent in Denver in the juvenile court was crucial to explaining how she would eventually become Denver's first vice cop. At that point, though, she comes out of Vassar in 1908. She works in the juvenile court until 1909, and then she was very determined to go to graduate school to continue her study of social sciences, because she thought that would help her be a better and more effective reformer. So she went back east. She went to New York City. She gets involved in all kinds of reform campaigns there while she's working on graduate degrees at Columbia in political science. And while she's there for a few years, but she really never, an academic career was clearly never in her sights. she wanted to be in the thick of it, on the ground, building institutions and creating legislation that would diminish inequalities. So she was never an ivory tower kind of graduate student. And she longed to go back to Denver because she had these friends there who could make possible for her activism on the ground, and because women voted in Colorado. In the early teens, women were not yet voting in New York. Women had been voters since the early 1890s in Colorado. And so political power was a real magnet for her. So she just really wanted to go back to Denver. And in 1912, her buddies back in Denver succeeded in getting a new position created. It was called, I think, Inspector of Amusements. And they thought Josephine Roche, their protege, would be perfect to come back and serve in the position of Inspector of Amusements. And so they asked her, would she be willing to come? And she said, you bet, dropped her graduate studies and went back to Denver to be a person who prowled through the Vice District every night in the wee hours of the morning. She would be prowling to make sure that kids, especially that adolescents, were not drinking themselves to stupors or being sexually taken advantage of in those vice districts. That's how she became a vice cop in Denver.
Wow. Now, you tell us in the book that her parents' political and societal views were quite different from hers, which is hardly unusual for children to have different views, I guess. But still, they provided her with this wonderful education that opened up all these what came to be lifelong connections in many cases that you just spoke of. One can imagine they could have shut her down and repressed her, but they didn't. You know, I don't, nature versus nurture and all that. She was an intelligent and driven person, but they didn't take opportunity away from her, did they?
No, they didn't. I mean, that's a great point. Her relationship with her parents is really, really interesting, and I wish I knew a lot more about it. When she left her records to the University of Colorado at Boulder, she purged virtually every personal item from those records. And so there's only one, I think in just during the war, during World War One, she got an opportunity to go abroad. And in her records, there are telegrams from her parents to her as she's about to get on the boat and cross the Atlantic to go into the war zone. And those are the only messages of any kind that I can get my hands on directly from her parents to her, and none directly from her to her parents. So I wish I knew a lot more about her relationship with them. What I know is strictly from the outside, you know, what I can see she did and what they did. And it is a remarkable relationship because you're so right. I mean, her father was a pro-business Republican. He was anti-organized labor. He did not believe that the state or the political community should have any say in the operation of private property. He believed fully in the prerogatives of property. And here she comes, a pro-labor progressive who believed that private property carried public obligations, you know, and that every corporation had obligations as deep and important, as compelling to workers and consumers as to shareholders. So she just has a completely different vision of who ought to have power in American society and what kinds of rules ought to restrict, especially businessmen. But even so, even though they had very different views, as soon as she came out of college, she still seems to have had a really, really good relationship with them, so that she lived with them for the year after college, and then when she came back to be a vice cop, even though they didn't want her to be a vice cop, they thought that was no job for her. I'm sure they were worried sick about her. As a parent myself, I can sure understand that. But she did it anyway, and she lived with them while she was doing this work that they didn't approve of. And then when, after she finished her stint as a vice cop, she stayed in Denver for a year longer. And during that time, she developed her most pro-labor commitments and was, this was the year of the Ludlow Massacre. She's living with her dad at that point, and her dad was an officer in a coal mining company already at that point. And she is out on the road agitating on behalf of the coal miners who are on strike while her father is engaging in some of the anti-labor tactics that she most abhorred. And yet they seem to have lived together in peace and to have loved each other dearly, because these, and the evidence for that would be that when just a few months really after the end of that coal strike, Roche gets the opportunity to go to Europe, I have these beautiful telegrams from her father and her mother to her as she's about to set out on the boat, calling her dear girl, most precious child, saying to her how much they loved her, how proud of her they were, how worried they'll be when she goes into the heart of this terrible war, and yet they wouldn't have it any other way because they know that's where she wants to be, and they're so proud of her. And, you know, they're signed oceans of love, Mama and Papa. So it's clear that, and then when her father was ill in the late 1920s, Roche was in D.C. She was in D.C. at that point working for the Children's Bureau in the Federal Department of Labor. And her father became very ill, and she quit her job and went back to Denver, went back to the juvenile court, which she did not want to do, but she wanted to be able to make her living, and she wanted to be there to take care of her mom and dad. And so she was nursing her father through his last 2 years of life, and her mother also became ill during that period, and she nursed her mother as well. They both died then in 1927. So it's clear that they were devoted to each other, even despite these very profound political differences.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
It is. This is Tom Clamer, and the other voice you've been hearing is that of Robin Munsey, author of Relentless Reformer, Josephine Roche and Progressivism in 20th Century America. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back after you listen to this.
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media. New public media now.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and I want to invite you to tune in to Tell Somebody with Tom Clamer every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now!, right here on KKFI.
Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is your host, Tom Clamer, and we have been talking to Professor Robin Munsey about her recent biography of Josephine Roche. Before the break, we were talking about how politically in opposition she was with her parents, which is especially striking in you mentioned the Ludlow Massacre, where he was an officer in a coal company in opposition to the union and the miners, and in a major event in labor history in 1914 that was a major motivating or impacting event in her life. That just blows me away.
It is. It's just remarkable. I so wish that I had more evidence about conversations that they had. Like, I wonder if the father and daughter actually discussed the strike, or if later on they talked about their differing views, or if maybe they just didn't mention those things at home. You know, maybe they just talked about something else once they were actually at the dinner table together. I would love to know, and yeah, but it's just not in the cards, I guess. The evidence is just not there.
Yeah. Again, we're on and on with singular, unexpected achievements for a woman, or for anybody for that matter, in this time period. But also later on, she had a viable, serious run at the governorship of Colorado. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You bet. Yeah, in 1934, Roche ran in the Democratic primary for governor of Colorado, and she did it. Let's see, where shall we start this story? She was a very committed New Dealer. She was very skeptical about FDR when he was on the campaign trail. She really, in 1932, she really wrestled over whether to support Franklin Roosevelt or to vote for Norman Thomas. A lot of progressives thought that Norman Thomas, the socialist candidate, was a lot more appealing because his platform was a lot clearer. You may remember that. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt had been a progressive governor of New York, but when he became the Democratic nominee for the presidency in 1932, his platform was really vague. It was hard to tell what exactly he planned to do. And so Roche was very worried that he would just be another Hoover, that he just wouldn't do anything that could match the need created by the Great Depression. So she, for a while, she was really on the fence, but ultimately she did support him. She worked for his campaign. And then in the early days of his presidency in 1933, she did all kinds of things, actually, for the New Deal government. She was appointed to a whole slew of advisory boards and that kind of thing. The most important thing she did early on was to help negotiate the coal code under the auspices of the National Recovery Administration. She's very important in that set of negotiations. And because of that, I'm sure you know that as a result of the National Recovery Administration, the coal industry unionized within a few months. That is, an industry that had just been completely down at the heel, revived like crazy, and the workers, something like 300,000 coal miners, signed cards that signed them up for the United Mine Workers of America in a couple of months. It's just remarkable. And so Josephine Roche, of course, is just thrilled out of her mind because this is exactly what she had dreamt of as a coal mine owner since her father's death in 1927. You know, she had become the majority stockholder and the president and CEO of Rocky Mountain Fuel, had invited the United Mine Workers of America to organize the miners at Rocky Mountain Fuel and become then this great promoter and champion of organized labor, especially in the coal industry. But she hadn't gotten much support, and in fact, other coal mine owners had tried to drive her out of business through a price war because they so disapproved of her support for organized labor in the industry. So when Roosevelt was elected and the National Industrial Recovery Act passed in 1933, and the industry then tried to organize in such a way that the coal mine owners cooperated with each other, and they had to recognize organized labor and had to engage in collective bargaining because of this new policy, Roche was just over the moon. So she was really sold on the New Deal within the first few months because of the National Recovery Administration. And out in Colorado, meanwhile, where her company is, the governor of Colorado, who was a Democrat, Edwin Johnson, was a Democrat, but he was not very interested in cooperating with the New Deal government at all. And old Harry Hopkins, who was running the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, was trying to get Colorado to come up with the matching funds that they were supposed to come up with to justify and support the provision of additional funds from the federal government for people who needed things like coal for winter heating, food, and money to pay their rent. You know, the FERA, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, was created in order just to help meet the most basic needs of people for survival. But the states were supposed to put up matching funds, and Colorado's governor and legislature held out. So eventually, in January of 1934, there's actually a threat of violence among unemployed Coloradans who are desperate for help. And Harry Hopkins in the federal government is saying, look, I can't keep sending money to you unless you come up with the matching funds. I'm going to cut off these this aid money. You can't keep getting it if you're not going to cooperate. And the governor said, what do I care about you? And unemployed men began to threaten violence at the state legislature in Denver in January of 1934. And under threat of that violence, finally the state legislature came up with the matching funds and the money flowed from Washington as well. During that standoff, a lot of people said, I think Colorado might need a new governor, somebody who's going to cooperate with the New Deal government. And nobody looked like a better candidate for that than Josephine Roche, who had been doing so much work with the New Deal government, working on this coal code. So she eventually was convinced to throw her hat into the gubernatorial ring in this would have been late spring, early summer of 1934. And her slogan, her campaign slogan, was Roosevelt, Roche, and Recovery. As she ran a really, really exciting campaign, she had this old car that she drove all over the Rockies and then all over the eastern plains of Colorado, proclaiming her eagerness to tie Colorado more tightly to the New Deal policies that she thought would be so good for Colorado. And she had the support, of course, of organized labor in Colorado and of progressives there. But in the end, even though she won Denver, hands down, she won Boulder, she won some coal counties out in western Colorado as well as in the northern coal fields, still she ultimately lost that primary to Edwin Johnson. And just after the general election then, Roosevelt scooped her up into his own administration, and that's when she became the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in December of 1934.
Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. And you have a quote from her in the book that I'd like to read. Speaking of selfish businessmen opposed to FDR and the New Deal, she said, apparently a deficit written in the red blood of millions of human lives is preferable to them to a red ink one written on paper. And that could, you know, come out of the mouths of, the Greek finance minister right now, speaking about austerity in the EU, or of what I think is very foolish and hurtful deficit of obsession in this country, with several states calling for a national constitutional amendment for a balanced budget. I mean, this is a lot of the same fight back then as now, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, one of the things that is just so interesting and compelling about reading, I think, about studying Josephine Roche and the New Deal period, the Progressive Era themselves, is that the reformers in those periods were looking at a situation so similar to our own. I mean, the kinds of, you're absolutely right. I mean, so many of the quotations coming out of her mouth or her opponents' mouths could easily be coming out of the mouths of reformers today or their opponents. It's deja vu all over again it's just eerie how similar the problems are and our positions are. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a big fight in the 1930s within the Democratic Party as well as within the Republican Party. It's not between the parties so much as within the parties at that point. Big fight between those who are absolutely committed to a balanced budget and those who think you can't be worrying about a balanced budget when people are suffering to the extent that they're suffering. We have to meet the suffering first and then worry about the balanced budget, if we ever need to worry about that really at all. And Roche really did face that battle and fight that battle in the Treasury itself with Henry Morgenthau. I mean, Henry Morgenthau was the Secretary of the Treasury and, of course, a progressive in some ways, but he was really nervous about deficit spending. I mean, that just really worried him, and it didn't worry Roche at all so long as the money was being spent on increasing the purchasing power of people who needed it. So within the Treasury, she and Morgenthau just went at it throughout her time in the Treasury. That would be from 34 to 37. She is just fighting constantly with him. And the time when that is the most obvious and consequential was when in 1937, Henry Morgenthau was able to convince FDR that it was time to pull back on government spending, and especially to pull back from spending on jobs. The WPA, the Works Progress Administration, was a place where Morgenthau said, you know, I think the private sector is going to be able to step up now. We have to let them step up. Let's pull back on spending for the WPA. And Roche was looking out at, you know, unemployment statistics and saying, you've got to be kidding. There are more people unemployed still than we can put that, than the private sector can possibly absorb. If they could, they would be doing it. But they're not doing it. And so what sense does it make to pull back spending and create an increase in unemployment? This is going to be a disaster for people.
Yeah.
They went on at it. And, of course, in the end, in 1937, FDR took Morgenthau's advice and caused what was then called the Roosevelt Recession, because the private sector was not ready to absorb those workers. There was a new increase in unemployment, and FDR in 1938 re-increased federal spending because he had learned his lesson. So there, you know, that fight over, or that anxiety about the balanced budget and preventing deficit spending and the like, that inclination or that worry, that set of values, was very much evident within the administration as well as outside it. Of course, there are critics of the administration altogether who are mouthing that set of values. But there are also people in the administration who are really worried about it, and Roche was up against one of the most vociferous of those.
Yeah, so little time left, and so many things I want to get to if we can, including if you could briefly lay out on Social Security, what was her role in Social Security, and you know, how important was she relative to Frances Perkins and other people in the Roosevelt administration for designing this?
Yeah, so Social Security. Social Security Act was devised in part by a five-person cabinet committee that was chaired by Frances Perkins. So Frances Perkins is absolutely crucial here. She was the person who pressed FDR hardest to get him to move forward with old age pensions and unemployment compensation and age-dependent children, all of which were in the Act. She's also very interested in health insurance, which, of course, didn't appear in the Act. But she really pressured him to move forward with some kind of social insurance. And one of the people who was on this five-member committee, the Committee on Economic Security, initially was Henry Morgenthau from the Treasury. But once Roche was appointed Assistant Secretary, because of her experience in social welfare, Morgenthau asked her to represent the Treasury on the Committee on Economic Security instead of him. So she goes on to that committee in December of 1934, and the legislation was due to the president at the end of that month. In the end, it didn't make it to his desk at the end of that month. It made it the next month. But so she's in on the final weeks, really, of discussion of the final Social Security bill. And she worked hardest on unemployment compensation. That was the her biggest interest and where she had the most experience because she had been, was, in fact, at the time, a business owner as well as a person absolutely committed to organized labor. And she was very interested in making the unemployment compensation program as redistributive as possible and as reliable for workers as possible. So her real her most important contribution to the Social Security Act, I would say, was in including as many workers as she could possibly include in its coverage, and for making sure it was designed in such a way that if a worker moved from one company to another, the worker would not lose any kind of unemployment compensation benefits. You'd still be protected by the program.
I think readers will need to get your book to fully appreciate her work from beginning to end of her career related to health care.
Oh, yeah.
But if what she was proposing and advocating had been passed about the time Social Security was, what kind of health care would we have now? Would it be like single payer? Would it be something like all the rest of the civilized world has? What do you think?
Really kind of hard to say what would have happened had she gotten her way, but it does seem much more likely that we would have a national health service, like Britain's maybe, or some sort of single-payer plan. It seems like that would have been much more likely because she's proposing this national health plan in the 1930s before any private or before very many private insurance companies had gotten into health care at all yet. Because healthcare was just health insurance was something that was so newfangled in the 1930s. A lot of people businessmen just couldn't imagine how would you insure health because it's so unpredictable, you know. And so you didn't have private health insurance yet. And if a public plan of any kind could have gotten traction in the late 30s or early 40s before there had been major corporate traction, it does seem that the road to single payer or a national health service would have been pretty smooth. So that by the time you'd come to 1948, when Harry Truman is actually presenting his national health insurance plan, if there had not been a lot of national, or if there hadn't been a lot of corporate health plans now up and running, you wouldn't have had that kind of corporate opposition to a public plan. So it does seem like if she had been able to get what she wanted in the late 30s and early 40s, our health care situation would be very different from what it is today.
Yeah.
Very different.
Hopping around in time here a bit, and again, so much I wish we could go a couple hours, but say a little bit about her taking over the Rocky Mountain Fuel Coal Company after the death of her father, and, you know, the impression that some had that this was a bleeding heart feminine using daddy's inheritance to run things as opposed to being a tough and competent businesswoman.
Yeah, so Josephine Roche came into her dad's shares of the Rocky Mountain Fuel Company when he died in 1927. She did not have a majority holding at that point, so she couldn't run the company the way that she wanted to run it in 1927 because she didn't have the majority of the stock yet. But she, instead of selling out, I mean, a lot of her advisors, her dad's advisors, said, you know, just sell out and live off the money. Enjoy this. They couldn't imagine that she would actually be interested in running the company. But since she was committed to, in her words, righting the wrongs of Ludlow, which she referred to earlier, she saw in these shares an opportunity to do right by coal miners and to show the world what a just corporation would look like. And so she amassed enough shares to become the majority stockholder, kicked out the sitting management, and invited her progressive friends to run the company with her. They then invited the United Mine Workers of America to organize the miners at Rocky Mountain Fuel and negotiated an historic contract in 1928. From that point on, she was anathema to the other coal companies in Colorado who tried to drive her out of business, but the miners themselves saved the company by loaning their wages at one point to allow her to make payments on a bond debt that the company had taken on years before she took over the company. So she becomes, she ran the company hand in glove with the miners themselves from then on out. She was represented, however, and this is what you're alluding to that's so important, in the press, instead of referring to her continually as an efficient coal magnate, an industrialist who had figured out how to run a corporation in a just way, she was often referred to as a social worker or humanitarian, and the way that she ran the company was, in some people's minds, in some journalists' minds, was an example of female compassion rather than the kind of hard-headed businesswoman that she was. And so I think that one of the reasons that her gender breakthrough here as a coal magnate didn't serve as an opening wedge for other women was because she was not represented consistently as an industrialist or a businesswoman or a hard-headed business person interested in the bottom line, which of course she was. She was represented as a social worker, that what she did was a kind of social work rather than business. So I think that's another one of the reasons that her breakthroughs didn't always, and in fact rarely, turned out to be a major breakthrough for women in general, which she would have loved for her innovations to have been.
And I suppose, obviously her fellow coal miner capitalist didn't care much for her approach, but I can imagine radical leftists might have thought her too much a capitalist.
Absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Tom. I mean, because she was, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, were in Colorado in the late 1920s, and she couldn't negotiate with them, even though she believed actually that some of their values were in line with hers, but some of them weren't. For instance, she believed that her job was to meet the legitimate interests or serve the legitimate interests of shareholders, consumers, and workers. And she thought in order to serve consumers, you had to be able to assure a reliable supply of coal. And to assure a reliable supply of coal, you had to have a workforce that wasn't going to go on strike just any time they wanted to. You had to sign a contract, and they had to say, if you provide these kinds of wages, hours, safety measures, then we promise we won't go on strike for this number of years until we're up to negotiate another contract. And that way, she thought, you've guaranteed consumers the meeting of their needs, and that they had a legitimate need too. And since the IWW wouldn't negotiate a contract or promise not to strike during a contract, she didn't believe that she could do right by everybody with a legitimate interest in coal. And so you're absolutely right. She was too much a capitalist for the far left. And not nearly enough of one for people like the Rockefellers and her other competitors in coal in the Colorado coal fields.
Well, Professor Robin Muncy, we've just got a couple of minutes left, and we're leaving out so much, including the entire post-Roosevelt, post-war career with the United Mine Workers Union and John L. Lewis. Which is pretty important stuff, so I hope you will turn to the book and find out about that. But I wonder if you could just give us a few thoughts about the specific subtitle you chose, Relentless Reformer, And, you know, I have to imagine that doing a biography, there's a temptation to do a hagiography, and I don't think you've done that, but it is a positive account. But she was not a purist, not a saint, and sometimes went for what was effective, maybe than what was purely right. Could you comment briefly on that, and then any final thoughts you want to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very heartened that you that message has gotten through. I mean, I think that one of the important things for people who write the stories, especially of women's lives, is not to represent them as saints, because I think that that is not realistic. None of us is a saint, and that if you're going to be effective in the world, you're probably going to have to make compromises that you're not that proud of. And if we write histories that gloss over those horrible choices that force pretty much all of us to compromise at times, if we write lives as though you don't have to make those choices, then we misrepresent the past and we misrepresent our options in the present. So I think being honest about the moments when somebody was facing bad options and made a choice that maybe many of us would not have made or wish she hadn't made, facing those really honestly, I think, is important to humanizing women, making them real people, and for demonstrating to all of us that just because you have to compromise doesn't make your work unimportant or ineffective. So, yeah, Josephine Roche was not a saint. She did make some decisions, some bargains with the devil here and there, that in a perfect world she would not have made. But she never made a decision on the basis of her own personal on the basis of her own personal enrichment. Whenever she was faced with a dilemma, the uppermost value in her mind was, you know, how do I serve workers? I mean, that really was the top. That was the top value. And how do I remain effective in the world? And so if she felt like one of her bad options was just going to sideline her so that she couldn't have any effect in the world, she didn't choose that. She chose what would help her remain effective, which I think is understandable, but in some cases it wasn't laudable.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to leave it about at that. The book is Relentless Reformer, Josephine Roche and Progressivism in 20th Century America. The author is Professor Robin Muncy. Robin Muncy, thank you very much for spending some time with us on Tell Somebody.
Thank you, Tom. This has been a great pleasure.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.